May it please the court, my name is Greg Smith, representing American National, National Western, and the other appellants. We seek reversal of the district court's dismissal of this case, especially with prejudice. The district court failed to apply this court's precedent in auction company, literally. The auction company case is never discussed or even cited in the opinion below, despite auction company being discussed at length by the parties below. Thus, the district court never applied FIREA's jurisdictional bar as laid out and described and defined in auction company. Instead, the district court simply viewed
auction company didn't decide the question.
I'm sorry?
Auction company didn't decide the question.
Your Honor,
that was all dictum.
It was all dicta.
Yeah.
Your Honor,
it wasn't necessary for the decision.
Your Honor, it was decided in a petition for rehearing, right. And
it's very interesting language, but I don't think you can call it a holding. So,
Your Honor, respectfully, it was decided in rehearing in an effort to clarify what the precedent being laid down by the court was. Mm-hmm. I understand the court's comments, but let's take it from there. The auction company's comments, regardless of how characterized, I think they were well reasoned.
Okay.
And
that's
I say that.
Argument.
I'm sorry?
That's a different argument. But
well,
go ahead with it. That's
understood.
That's where you want to go.
Okay. Well, let me address that. What it said was quite logical, which is simply you don't view D13D in isolation. You view it in context. You view it harmoniously with the other provisions. And viewing D13D and D6 together, it establishes a standard exhaustion requirement. As it explains, otherwise we'll have it would be an immunity provision that Congress never intended and would raise serious constitutional questions. That's consistent with what other circuits have ruled, the Tenth Circuit, the Second Circuit, and Bank of New York.
What are the constitutional questions?
The constitutional question would be establishing an immunity without providing for an administrative claim. The issue is whether the administrative, whether the jurisdictional.
You're essentially a taking of your state law claim without just compensation. Is that what you're saying?
It would be eliminating the state law claim without any administrative possibility and without any judicial possibility because it would be jurisdictionally barred.
Well, if it does that, though, you have a cause of action in the claims court, don't you, for taking without just compensation? And not only that, that's not something that we have jurisdiction to decide, is it?
You would not have jurisdiction over a claims court case, but you can avoid the constitutional question. What auction company did was it decided the way it did by a point.
There's nothing unconstitutional about a taking. It's only if you don't get just compensation. So if it eliminates your state claim, and it's a good claim, then go to the Federal Court of Claims and get compensated for it.
Well, let me address, if I can, directly the D13 exhaustion argument, because there seems to be an impression that D13, D2, jurisdictionally bars this claim, that it covers it by talking about being related to acts or omissions of the FDIC. I don't think it is plain, and let me give you an example. If there were an estate, trust and estate context, and there were a will or a statute that's limited the estate beneficiaries or anyone from filing, quote, claims relating to the acts or omissions of the estate's executor, eliminating any action, any claims relating to the acts or omissions of the state of the estate's executor. That law is there to protect the executor. It's not to bar claims against a third party who defrauded or tricked the executor.
Is it there to have anything to do with claims against a third party?
It shouldn't have anything to do with claims against a third party. That's right. If in the executor example, suppose a third.
Can you tell me that's right? Because that was a question. I can't be right or wrong in a question. I was just asking that. Go ahead.
Does it affect the third party claims?
Yeah.
It should not reach third party claims any more than the executor clause would affect third party claims. If a third party gave a false appraisal of the family farm to the executor, that's not the kind of claim that barring claims related to the acts or omissions the estate's executor is supposed to cover. It's not supposed to immunize the tortfeasor. If someone leaked false information about pollution on a farm.
You say it's not the kind of, I mean, how do we know that?
Well,
D13 seems to deal with the subject matter of the claim, whereas D6 deals with the identity of the individual, of the party, right? One deals with subject matter, one deals with the identity of the defendant, the depository institution. So the question is, I suppose, how do you reconcile those two provisions?
And what auction company says is that you that you view them harmoniously as a standard exhaustion requirement. And I think that's a logical way of dealing with it, and it's consistent with what the Tenth Circuit said and the Third Circuit or the Second Circuit said. You view it in context to avoid the potential constitutional question or the potential taking. A taking should be avoided if possible. And there are federalism concerns here as well. If you view it that way, you're eliminating state law claims. And state law claims ought to have the ability to be heard in state court. So in the third-party context, in the appraisal, that type of provision is not designed to eliminate claims against a third party. If the third party tricks the executor into selling the family farm at a fire sale price because they're the only bidder left at the end of the day after they've told people that land is polluted, after they've given a false appraisal on the farm, that doesn't limit the ability of the third party to be sued. That's not what this provision that says that they're barring claims relating to the acts or omission of the estate's executor is designed to prevent.
So
any more
think,
than here.
Do you think that Seventh Circuit's decision in Oakbrook was wrong?
I think the Bank of New York case was correct.
Oakbrook, the Seventh Circuit decision. Village of Oakbrook, Sixth Circuit, sorry.
Your Honor, I don't think we need to go that far.
That was only against the bank, the third party. It wasn't against
it. It was, but significantly, Your Honor, it was an aiding and abetting claim. You couldn't. I think it's perfectly reconcilable. Village of Oakwood involved a claim of aiding and abetting against the third party. The third party had aided and abetted the principal, the FDIC, as the wrongdoer. They couldn't get a claim that they couldn't win the case unless they proved that the FDIC committed actionable wrongs.
But don't you have? Excuse me. Go ahead.
No, you.
Don't you have to have some, at least, misfeasance by the FDIC in order to win here? The argument got couched as standing, and perhaps correctly, in some of the briefs, but as far as claim for relief, you have no claim against the third parties unless the FDIC did something that destroyed your value as bondholder, right?
No, Your Honor. We have a claim directly against the JPMC
for JPMC's
own wrongdoing.
For doing what?
For diminishing the value of the bonds before the receivership, before there even was an FDIC receiver.
So you're going to be measuring your damage from a time before the receivership?
It includes damages before. We ought to have the ability to present an analysis, an expert analysis.
Well, they didn't cause any damages after the receivership. FDIC had to act before those damages occurred. It's a causation problem in standing terms, but it could be a claim for relief action. As I'm not sure how you could prove a diminution of value before the receivership that was caused by anything they did.
Well, we ought to be able, as in a securities case, to bring in an expert to talk about the diminution of value and link it directly to the...
I don't know any securities case really parallels this, where you've got something that is dramatically damaged in value by the act of the FDIC, to try to come back and say, well, even if the FDIC hadn't acted, this would have been diminished because the other part, third party, went around talking bad about the bank?
They eliminated other bidders, and that's something that happened before the FDIC sold, and that was a...
How did they eliminate other bidders?
They eliminated other bidders.
How did they eliminate other bidders?
We had an email that we submitted below that showed that the Bank of Spain was discouraged and run off from...
Eliminate them. They discouraged them, right?
Well,
that was the Third Parties Act that chose not to bid in. You've got a real causation, but I think you did a very clever job in the brief of dealing with it, but you've got a real causation problem.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, they leaked confidential information that they had obtained pursuant to the confidentiality agreement. They breached the confidentiality agreement in order to leak information, just like in the estate comment, leaking information about pollution on a farm that was false.
I'm not sure that the analogy to a hypothetical imaginary farm is going to get you very far, counsel.
Right. Well, I will move on. Let me talk about the direct causation, because all we have to show is that it's fairly traceable to JPMC's acts. The fact that an injury is indirect doesn't negate standing. Under Texas law, an intervening act doesn't relieve an actor of liability unless the third party intentionally caused harm that was not within the scope of the risk. This was a risk that JPMC not only created but caused in terms of implicating the FDIC's efforts.
I don't want to interrupt your flow, but why does Texas law govern?
Because the state law claim, and it's covered by Texas law, the causation would be a substantive question of Texas law because these are Texas state law claims.
But why does, in a conflicts of law analysis, why does Texas law govern? Why not New York law?
Well, Your Honor, we submit that these were...
Been decided, right? I'm just
understood,
asking
but these would
what
be,
your argument is.
It's not been disputed that we submitted this was subject to Texas substantive law, and the other side didn't dispute that. I want to reserve...
Well, we haven't gotten far enough for them necessarily to have disputed it yet. Right. Can you answer Judge Randolph's question? Why should Texas law govern?
Are any of the bondholders that you represent, are they incorporated in Texas?
Yes, Your Honor.
All of them? Where did the acts occur?
The acts occurred, we submit in Texas. So
J.P. Morgan was acting in Texas.
Yes, Your Honor.
Where was Washington Mutual, its principal place of business?
Its principal place of business was in Washington State.
Yeah, I thought so.
Before you sit down, I want to ask you about the FDIC's alternative argument under 1821 D2A. I mean, their argument is that even if this claim could go forward because it's only against the third party, the FDIC argues that under this provision of the statute, this is a claim the FDIC now owns.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
I don't think that's correct because we're suing for tortious interference with the bond contracts.
Yeah.
We're the holders of the contracts. The FDIC is not. This is direct injury to our bond rights.
Right.
And even
the
if
statute, what's concerning me is the statute creates a series of priorities, right?
Yes.
And as you
or
represent
contracts.
Some creditors, and you're fairly low on the list, if you're able to bring this suit, isn't the risk that you'll be jumping the line for
no, Your Honor,
entitlement to the assets of the?
We're not seeking any assets of the failed bank or the FDIC receiver. We're only seeking assets of Chase. It will not affect the priorities whatsoever. And that's the thrust of our contention here. We are suing a third-party tortfeasor only for the third-party tortfeasor's
assets. The statute says that the FDIC succeeds to all rights, titles, powers, and privileges of the insured depository institution.
And these are not claims of the depository institution. They are bondholder claims held by the bondholders.
Aren't these derivative claims?
Yeah.
These are derivative claims, right?
I don't know, Your Honor. There are perhaps claims that FDIC could bring, but they are not these bondholder claims. These bond, if anything, the FDIC they're having their liabilities eliminated. These are not claims they could bring. And even if they did have claims, they're not.
Because they're direct claims owned by the creditors, they're not derivative claims?
But all of that, see, that's why I asked you the question about why Texas law governs. The questions that Judge Tatel was posing to you were questions that occurred to me as well. All of this, whether it's a derivative claim or whether the depository institution has the exclusive right, or you can bring claims. All that depends on state law, and I don't know what the law of Texas is. I think you cite some cases, but it's not so clear to me that even Texas law applies in this situation. So I'm kind of at sea about how you reach any kind of a decision on that question. You agree it depends on state law, don't you? There's no federal common law that governs this.
I think that's right, Your Honor. Yes.
Yeah.
All right. I want to reserve
it looks
at least.
Awfully derivative. Your claim is they diminish the value of an institution on which you held bonds, and you were harmed thereby. Is that correct? Or
we are saying that they eliminated our ability. They stripped the funds that could be used to pay for the bonds.
But isn't that a claim that any creditor could bring?
Yeah.
That's a general claim by...
It's not a universal claim. Your claim is going to depend on when you own the bonds. If you didn't own the bonds when the tort occurred...
No, so it's beyond not, the bondholders, couldn't any creditor of the Washington Mutual make the same kind of argument?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. No. Okay. I want to...
Okay, thank you, counsel. We'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Joseph Brooks for the FDIC Legal Division. I think the key issue was one that was hit on by, I believe, Judge Santel, and that is that the insurance companies here can have no claim under their complaint unless and until the FDIC as receiver sells these assets allegedly at a below market price. The complaint pleads that almost immediately before the sale, Washington Mutual Bank was sufficiently capitalized and fully liquid. And it further pleads that immediately after the sale, J.P. Morgan Chase, in financial documents, took the position that the assets they had obtained were worth more than $1.9 billion more than the price that they paid. Absent the sale of those assets at that alleged $1.9 billion premium, insurance companies are not able to show any harm. And it's all well and good to say...
I don't
say,
understand that. Their complaint alleges that Chase, through its pre-sale actions, depressed the price that the FDIC ultimately sold the assets to them for. That's their claim. That's what the complaint, and this was dismissed, right? So we have to view the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiffs. And they allege this broad series of actions by Chase, I don't know whether they're true or not, but we have to accept them as true, of efforts by Chase to depress the value of the bank, the value of Washington Mutual. But, and they're suing for that. And they're suing Chase, not anybody else. I don't get the causation problem.
The answer to your question, I believe, Your Honor, is if, as they contend, the assets on the day of sale by FDIC receiver were worth $1.9 billion more, and by the way, I think the value, total value of their claim, if you add up their bonds, is in the nature of a relatively paltry $40 million as opposed to $1.9 billion. What they're saying is, had the assets been sold for their fair market value, there would have been more than enough assets available to satisfy their claims.
Right.
Regardless of whether there is any diminishment in the value of Washington Mutual Bank, it does not harm the bondholders unless the receivership estate has insufficient assets to pay their claims. If their claims could be paid in full by the receiver, they would have no cognizable harm. And so it is that because they allege, as a matter of fact, their complaint cannot plead around it, that the critical event here that caused them harm was the sale of those assets at a price that did not realize sufficient return.
Is this different from your argument that they should have filed their claim through the claims process?
Well, it's the same argument, Your Honor, and indeed it is indistinguishable from Village of Oakwood. In Village of Oakwood, what the plaintiffs who sued the assuming bank alleged was that the FDIC had acted in a manner. What the FDIC allegedly did there was it misclassified deposits that were uninsured.
They
deposits.
Don't, this complaint doesn't make any allegations about the FDIC.
Nor did that complaint.
Sure, it did. It alleged that the in Village of Oakwood, it alleged that the bank, that the third party aided and abetted the FDIC's actions.
Right,
and that's why it could go through the claims. But let me ask you the question this way:
yes.
How could the plaintiffs' claims here be resolved through the FDIC's claims process?
Well,
since it's a claim against Chase.
Well, certainly in the first instance, Your Honor, the claims could have been completely denied if the FDIC had determined.
But suppose the FDIC thought that their claims had merit.
Well, if the FDIC
how could the FDIC rule that their claims against a third party had merit, since they were seeking payment from Chase? The FDIC doesn't even have the power to order Chase to appear, does it?
No, Your Honor, and nor does the statute require that it does. There are two parts to D13D.
Yeah.
The first, the second part, which was the primary one, I think the exclusive one relied on by the district court here, says that the claims process applies to claims that relate to an act or omission of the receiver. That provision of the statute does not say that the receiver needs to be able to award damages to a third party if the third party's claims directly relate to an act or omission. This is precisely the situation.
Repeat yourself. You said the D says the claims process relates to, and then any claim.
Well, D13D says the jurisdiction.
It doesn't say any. It just deals with jurisdiction of any court. It doesn't say. Right. It doesn't deal with jurisdiction of the FDIC. So I don't think your invocation of that provision answers Judge Tatel's question. Well, how could it?
Well, perhaps I misunderstood the question. The point that I was trying to make, perhaps ineloquently, is that this case is precisely like Village of Oakwood because the same thing was sought there. The claim was filed solely against an assuming bank, and one could ask the question, how could the FDIC have awarded damages there? The claim against the assuming bank was based on an alleged misaction by the FDIC.
Can I back you up a little bit? Because I'm interested in the same question that Judge Tatel raised with you. You don't dispute in your brief the following proposition, that any claim that is barred from judicial review under 6 or 13 has to be a claim that the FDIC could adjudicate.
I would phrase it slightly differently, Your Honor. I don't believe that the case law under D13, D1 or 2 says that the FDIC would need to be able
forget
to...
Forget what the case law says.
We're not bound by those cases.
So. Well, I think the point here is that the claim in this case is not a claim exclusively.
You say they should have brought, the bondholders should have brought their claim before the agency, right?
Correct.
You do not dispute the proposition that they argue, which is that if the agency doesn't have jurisdiction, they don't have to bring the claim before the agency. You seem to say, that the agency, the FDIC, would have had jurisdiction to adjudicate that claim.
Yes, and
that's what Judge Tatel was asking. That's what I want to know. And I also want to know what provision of this statute gives the FDIC authority to adjudicate claims against third parties. In other words, against other than a depository institution or the corporation itself. Can you give me the sections that do that?
Yes, Your Honor. The sections are D13, D1, and 2. The reasons deals
with judicial, the jurisdiction of a court.
I understand that, Your Honor. But going back, if we could, to where...
Is that your best authority?
Well, look, it is, but let me explain why.
I'm looking at the language of the statute that you just talked about. It says the FDIC shall allow the claim. And the question is, how can the FDIC allow a claim against a third party, not the institutional bank? And then it says, if it does allow the claim, it shall pay the claim. How can it pay the claim, since what they're seeking here is a remedy from a third party, not the assets of the failed institution?
If I might, Your Honor, if we're talking about...
That's the question.
Yeah, if I could. If we're talking about the statutory language in D6 and D13, and I do not dispute for one moment that there is a facial inconsistency, that issue, the fact that there's an inconsistency, was precisely addressed by Auction Company. What Auction Company did not do, though, it expressly declined to resolve it. But as this court pointed out in Auction Company,
that's the question we have to resolve now.
We have to resolve
it. And what we're asking you, and I'll try once more.
Sure.
Your position is that this claim barred because it didn't go through the claims process. They argue in their brief, the blue brief, that there's nothing the FDIC could do for this claim in the claims process. Your brief doesn't respond to that, and that's what we're all asking. Why would the FDIC force a party with a claim that can't be resolved through the claims process through that process? That's totally futile.
Because, Your Honor, in Village of Oakwood and in five other Court of Appeals, the courts have held that the claims process applies not to the limited scope of D.C.
In Village of Oakwood,
we're not bound by the case.
Village of Oakwood,
that's correct.
Taking it first principles.
Village of Oakwood had an aiding and abetting claim in it against a third party for aiding and abetting the actions of the FDIC. That is not in this case.
No, Your Honor, but the allegation here is that the FDIC sold assets for $1.9 billion less than they're worth.
Well, that's because the assets the FDIC, according as I understand the complaint, the theory behind it is that the reason they were less is that the behavior of the defendant reduced the value of Washington Mutual before the FDIC had a chance to sell it. In other words, it was probably worth $1.9 billion by the time they sold it, but for Chase's behavior, it would have been worth a lot more. Well, that's their theory.
In fact, Your Honor, their complaint. Right? In fact, the complaint goes a bit further than that. They allege that the FDIC worked in tandem with Chase to design bidding parameters that would exclude other bidders.
No, but remember, we're looking at a complaint that was dismissed on jurisdictional grounds. So we have to interpret this language in a way that's responsive to the plaintiffs, right? And you could interpret that paragraph as simply saying, look, FDIC's got to act really fast here. It's got to find buyers for these things. And sure, it had many pre-sale conversations with them. It always does that. But that complaint, that paragraph you're talking about, and Chase also relies on that paragraph, I think it's at Joint Appendix 51, does not, if you read this favorably to the plaintiff, allege aiding and abetting or a conspiracy. It just alleges that the FDIC was doing its job.
Your Honor, if I might go back to your earlier question about why I believe this court, not other courts, but this court, should interpret D13D 1 and 2 as the scope of the claims process. I don't believe that this court is writing on an entirely clean slate.
No, but you still haven't.
Because in Freeman, though, this very issue came up. The claims in Freeman were against the FDIC as receiver. They did not fit within D6A. Nevertheless, this court held, relying only on D13D 1, that because the claims were with respect to the rights of an asset of a failed bank, that both the claims exhaustion requirement and the jurisdictional requirement.
But that was against the FDIC. We're reviewing essentially an agency. No, it's not an agency, but we're reviewing essentially an agency. Here you have a third party, and isn't it possible, counsel, that Congress was using the word claims here in a restricted sense, referring to the kind of claims that were in the rest of this statutory scheme, not to the whole universe of claims that could exist related to a bank, that is to say against third parties. Is that not a possible construction of the statute?
Your Honor, that's certainly a possible construction, but
And if we construe it that way, then we reverse the dismissal, don't we?
Well, I would believe that you would have a problem then, Your Honor, because we have the language in D13D 2 and D13D 1 that jurisdictionally bar not just claims, but if you go to D13D 1, claims or actions with respect to the rights. So actions.
Yeah, but if we use claims in a restricted sense, would it not be logical that actions would be used in the same restricted sense, those that the statutory scheme is dealing with?
Well, if the statute on the one hand, in one part of the statute says claims, and in the immediate next subparagraph of D13 says claims or actions, I believe actions is relevant. And the rationale for it, Your Honor, is really quite simple. Look what happened here. The FDIC is inevitably drawn into this litigation. Your Honor, there is no...
They dived into the litigation.
But there's no claimant. There is no claimant.
I mean, they went out there and moved to be admitted. They weren't drawn into the litigation.
Well, Your Honor, there's an identification provision that potentially puts other creditors' rights at risk. There's
I'm not suggesting they shouldn't have. Right. They did get themselves in properly.
Mr. Brooks, before you sit down, I have two questions. One, the interpretation of D13 that you're arguing in favor of, is that embodied in any regulation or any formal decision by the FDIC?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. Okay. No, it's not.
The second question is, this is more of an observation than a question. I probably should have directed it to your opponent, and I will ask him when he stands up for rebuttal. There is a line of authority in this circuit, and one of the cases is Avocados Plus versus Venom, and it's 370 Fed 3rd, 1243, that says the following, that if there's a jurisdictional exhaustion requirement, then that has to be complied with even if the agency doesn't have any authority to adjudicate the claim. And the example of that is when a party, for example, argues that the whole statute under which the agency is operating is unconstitutional. agencies don't have authority to decide that the statute under which they're operating is unconstitutional. But we have held that nevertheless, even though the agency doesn't have any authority or any jurisdiction to adjudicate the claim, if the exhaustion requirement is, quote, jurisdictional, you still have to go through the process. And the Freeman case that you're relying on held that D13 is a jurisdictional exhaustion requirement. That's not an argument you made. I'm not clear why not. But anyway, I'd throw that out.
If I could quickly respond, Your Honor. It's not an argument we made. It's one that we alluded to because when we advised the court that six other circuits had resolved this issue the way we preferred, we pointed out that two of the circuits, I believe it's the 9th and the 11th, resolved them in the way you suggest by saying that D13 itself creates a jurisdiction, an exhaustion requirement as well as a jurisdictional requirement.
So okay, but let me pursue that, and then I have a question about your alternative theory. So then, just following up on Judge Randall's question, so is your theory then that the claims process, they have to exhaust the claims process because the claims process, the FDIC might be able to provide a remedy in it? Is that your theory, or that it doesn't make any difference?
It doesn't make any difference, Your Honor. Our theory is, as Judge Randolph just pointed out, the language of D13D clearly creates a jurisdictional bar here. A number of courts have suggested, inconsistent, I think, with the avocado authority alluded to by Judge Randolph, but a number of courts have suggested that that might create a due process issue because if there is no administrative process, you can't have the jurisdictional bar would eliminate chance for review. But putting that aside, Your Honor, there's no question that the jurisdictional bar applies here. And the FDIC's position has been, in order to avoid the due process issue, a number of courts have interpreted D13 as either incorporating D6's process or creating its own exhaustion process, and we think that's reasonable.
Wouldn't the logical way to handle that problem, if in fact it is a problem, is after a party files the claim and the FDIC says that we don't have any jurisdiction to decide it, then they come into court, and the time to decide that there's a due process problem is the time when you're adjudicating whether the court has jurisdiction.
Well, indeed, Your Honor.
Because that's where the due process problem is, rather than trying to adjust the exhaustion requirement, which seems pretty straightforward on its face, according to Freeman. So.
Your Honor, I would agree with you. And in fact, if a party filed a claim with the FDIC, and either because it was unable to or it was unwilling to afford a remedy, that party always has the right to seek de novo judicial review. That's what should have happened here.
Well, but your alternative theory is that they don't. Yeah. That under D2A, that's a right the FDIC owns, right?
Well,
isn't that your alternative theory?
Our alternative theory, if you get past the jurisdiction, is yes, Your Honor, this is not a claim for an individual bondholder.
Then it's not much of an answer to Judge Randolph to say, okay, they just have to go through this futile process, and then they can file a lawsuit, because your alternative argument is this is a claim the FDIC owns.
Well, Your Honor, I agree with
Catch
you.
Catch 22, right?
As a strategic matter, one could argue standing first or subject matter jurisdiction are both preliminary issues. The way that this litigation developed in the district court, the subject matter jurisdiction issue and standing issues were both presented to the district court judge, and the district court judge elected to resolve the case on subject matter jurisdiction.
I don't think that's properly called standing. Your argument, by the way, and I meant to ask you this, and you've just prompted, is that this is a claim that belongs solely to the depository institution, right? What law governs that? Isn't that a state law claim? And what state are you relying on for that proposition?
Well, the state law that would govern that, I believe, would likely be the state law of the incorporation of Washington Mutual Bank, which I believe is an association. And I must confess, I assume it's Seattle, Washington, but I don't know that to be the case. Certainly not Texas.
It could be Delaware. It could be anywhere.
Right.
Yeah, but you don't cite any Washington state cases.
Well, I was not.
You don't cite any cases from Delaware. You don't cite any cases from New York. You just cite the proposition. And I don't know where that comes from. Where do you get that from?
We also cite in our brief two earlier cases. I believe one's a district court case named Braslin. The other one's a court of appeals case I don't have...
Yeah, but that's federal, this is not federal law.
What law would they apply?
Well, the critical issue here, Your Honor, is that what we were relying on in response to their argument is the federal provision in FIREA that says that the FDIC stands in the shoes of the failed bank.
That depends on what those shoes are filled with, and those shoes, and that depends on state law, and you don't cite any state law, so...
Perhaps we should have, Your Honor. The state law issue was never contested. Today's the first time we heard that the Texas law is supposed to govern that issue. But I would agree with Your Honor that you could view this rather than as a standing issue, perhaps as a real party and interest issue under Rule 17. It doesn't matter.
It could be a claim for a relief issue.
Yeah.
It would just be a 12B6 issue, which is not a jurisdictional issue, but it... It would be the proximate cause rather than causation is the language.
Although there are courts, I believe, perhaps outside this jurisdiction that have described this as an Article III standing issue. But in any event, if that were true, that would answer Judge Tatel's question. The subject matter jurisdiction issue would have to be raised first. If this is not, in fact, a standing issue, it would be a latter issue.
I'm not deciding that it is or is not, but it is not a clear question.
I'm curious about your interpretation of I think it's D2A, the argument that this is the provision that the FDIC argues gives it the right, that says it owns this claim. The plaintiffs say, look, creditors are not listed in that statute, right? And your answer to that is, you say, you look at the first part of it and you say, yes, but the FDIC succeeds to all rights, titles, powers, and privileges, right? And that's what this comes under.
Correct.
Correct. Well, isn't that also true of the items that are in the rest of D2A? I mean, claims by shareholders, partners, they're all also derivative. So wouldn't they be covered by the generic provision of the statute also?
To the extent that the FDIC succeeds to those rights? Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, so then why do you need the list? Doesn't that make that just, unnecessary language? Wasn't needed.
Well, in any event, Your Honor, the argument that they're making is that because
what's the answer to that question, though? I'm trying to understand the statute. We're supposed to interpret statutes to give meaning to all words in them, and under your view of the statute, the only provision you need is that the FDIC succeeds to all rights, titles, and privileges of a failed institution.
With respect to this claim, Your Honor, if there were shareholders' claims, which are not in this case, if there were creditors' claims, which are not in this case, the point that the other side made is that bondholders are not included. And so the dispute is
But my
really
point is that shareholder claims are also derivative and could be considered rights, titles of the institution. So Congress didn't need the rest of that language under your theory. That's my point.
Well, that's an arguable point. It may depend on quirks of state law. There may be certain individual shareholders.
Internal state law.
Well, Your Honor,
I'm asking you about the interpretation of this federal statute.
Yeah, and my answer, perhaps I didn't answer clearly, is that whether or not a shareholder might have a claim that the corporation wouldn't would be an issue of state law. And Congress was perhaps anticipating the possibility that there would be individual claims that were not also collective claims under the relevant law. Here, however, it doesn't matter. I believe the issue that was brought up before about jumping the line illustrates what the problem is here. If the value of the corporation as a whole was diminished, okay, then whatever diminished it and whatever damages are awarded need to be distributed not just to these bondholders and not to them first, but to all creditors, all who were harmed by that, and according to the appropriate priority scheme. And that's the reason why Congress would have wanted the FDIC as the successor to the corporation to own those claims and not individuals who might go out and jump the line.
Okay, well, suppose you're right about that and you do, and the FDIC does own these claims under D2A, and the FDIC decides not to pursue them. Are there any circumstances under which the plaintiffs can then pursue them on their own?
The fully honest answer, Your Honor, is I don't know. But I had thought about this issue a bit, and perhaps under appropriate state law, there may be case law that suggests that shareholders and others might, under certain circumstances, have a right to bring a claim where the corporation
This particular claim, that I'm talking about this claim in this case.
Right.
I take it the FDIC, although it claims it owns the claim, isn't going to pursue it, correct?
To my knowledge, there's no intention to pursue it at
this
time.
Well, so given that, why couldn't the plaintiffs pursue it? Since the FDIC had decided not to pursue this claim that it owns, why can't they pursue it?
Well, I think primarily for the reasons I've suggested, Your Honor.
What are those?
If the individual bondholders can pursue these claims and recover these monies for themselves, they would be getting access to...
Well, no, they're seeking money from Chase. They're not seeking money from the FDIC. They're not seeking money from the failed institution. They're seeking it from Chase.
But again, the underlying assumption here is that they could somehow prove that claim.
That's not the question I ask you. You've gone back to your original. I'm asking you, I mean, whether they can prove the claim is a question. Maybe the FDIC thinks they can't prove it, which is why the FDIC isn't pursuing the claim. But they think they can prove it. And why does the FDIC care if they try? What's the harm? They're not seeking any funds that could be made available to any other possible beneficiary of the failed institution's assets.
Your Honor, I think the basic harm is this. It's the very purpose of the jurisdictional bar. The purpose of the jurisdictional bar is to allow the FDIC to do what it's supposed to be doing, winding up these failed banks.
But if all they're going after, or what they're going after, right, is a money damages claim against a third party, right, how does that interfere with the FDIC's ability to wind up the affairs of the Washington Mutual?
Because if their claim necessarily includes, as it does here, action of the FDIC.
It only does if you interpret the complaint the way you do. If you interpret the complaint in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, it doesn't.
Well, Your Honor, the district
And assuming court, that that's the case, what's the answer to the question?
Well, if you could assume a different set of facts that weren't
No, no. I want to assume the only facts I want to assume are the ones in the complaint. This is a complaint against a third party for funds from the third party.
To the extent that the complaint alleged damages that were based only on JPMC's conduct, let's say, for example, right, it's all pre-receivership conduct. If they could,
yeah,
and under 59E, we say with it, but if they could,
right,
then I believe Your Honor's correct.
They could proceed with that case.
Yes.
Well, I understood them to be arguing that. Now, I know it's very fuzzy around the edges, but when I asked counsel about that, he said he's actually claiming for diminution that occurred before the FDIC acted.
But the problem, Your Honor, is had he amended his complaint pre-judgment, he arguably could have done that. However, he did not. So he's into the situation.
Did they try to amend?
Not pre-judgment, no.
And okay, how is it any different?
Because under this court's jurisprudence in Firestone and Jung, where a party does not amend pre-judgment, a party can only seek to leave to amend post-judgment if it first prevails on a Rule 59E motion. That motion was denied below, and we think appropriately, because none of the standards were made. Indeed, the only...
Then should the dismissal have been with prejudice, or should it have been without prejudice?
No, the dismissal should have been with prejudice, because again, under primarily Jung, but also Firestone, unless...
If you are saying they didn't make that claim in the original complaint, then why should it be barred by the judgment here? Isn't it a sufficiently different complaint that they should be able to bring it?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think this is squarely governed by Jung, where that matching program was an essential element of the antitrust claim. The way that the complaint is pled here, as the district court found, and we agree, it is not possible to make allegations consistent with the original complaint that would overcome the jurisdictional bar. And that's the standard in this circuit under Firestone and Jung. The way that they pled, whatever he said here today, whatever they say in the brief, that complaint does not permit allegations that are consistent with it, that do not include a below market price sale. That is the linchpin of the damages claim in that complaint. And the fact that counsel for the insurance companies may come here today and say, oh, well, we'd like to come up with a different theory. The time to do that was
a different theory. It may be a contained theory, so we're back to whether the dismissal is correct. But even if they're claiming for diminution before the acts of the FDIC, the below market sale could still be evidence of a diminution occurring before the FDIC acted.
I would suggest, Your Honor, that the below market sale allegations are just the opposite, because their allegations are that afterwards, J.P. Morgan Chase claimed on its financial statements that the assets were worth $1.9 billion or more. That shows, if their allegations are taken as true, which they must be, that there was no diminution, at least not to an extent that impacted their rights.
Okay, we've now used up nearly 30 minutes of your allotted 10. So unless my colleagues have further questions, we'll let you sit down and call upon your co-party.
My apologies and thanks for the question.
It's not your fault. The late Spotswood Robinson said those lights only control the bar. Only God can control this bench.
Good morning, Your Honors. Since you've explored these issues ad nauseum, let me just go back to one issue that Judge Tatel was getting at, and perhaps I could offer an explanation for it, and that is the issue of marrying 1821d6 and 1821d13d, the difference in scopes, and why this claim should be one that should be subject to the administrative review process that is provided for in D6. It is a claim against a third party, and it's indeed true that the FDIC could not order relief against J.P. Morgan Chase in and of itself, but that does not mean that the claim is not one that should not be subject to administrative review. Properly marrying and giving scope to the statute would mean that you should incorporate the D6 administrative process within the full scope of 1821d13d. And D13D2 involves any claim relating to any act or omission of the receiver. It is clear whether this is asserted as a claim against the third party or not. This claim relates to the act of the receiver in selling the bank. Now, that may or may not, based on the interpretation of the complaint, be the liability-inducing event or even the harm, but it clearly relates to it. And there is a reason for the statute that it's not any claim against any third party, but you're talking about a claim here against the purchaser of the assets of the receivership from the receiver. It is directly implicated by relating to. And there's substantial reasons why a claim of that sort should be within the scope of the administrative review process, even if the FDIC is not empowered to grant relief against J.P. Morgan Chase itself. It would enable the FDIC to review the conduct of the FDIC to which this relates to, evaluate the claim, have the claim evaluated in a consistent time frame as part of the process of administering the assets of this receivership estate, and indeed even evaluate whether the receivership estate might have a claim against J.P. Morgan Chase if the complaint were to be interpreted, Your Honor, as Judge Tatel has said, perhaps it could be. I would argue this complaint is not subject to that interpretation.
Back you up just a minute.
Yes.
You're relying on D6, the claims process in D6. That's the way you began. That this claim that the bondholders have should be required to go through the process of D6.
Correct.
But D6 is dependent upon D5. And D5 defines the claim in terms of claims against a depository institution. Mm-hmm. So how can it possibly be that the claim that we have before us could go through the administrative process, since it's limited under D5 to claims against depository institutions?
And that language occurs again in D6, claims right. against a depository institution.
D6 is in general, and again, let's
go. What was that?
D6 is worded in general, and it's not necessarily exhaustive of the type of claims that could be subject to the administrative review process.
What, it says in general?
Yeah, it's the beginning. D6A says
well, no,
in
that's
general.
That's not part of the statute.
But I understand. But this court in auction properly found that there is an inherent inconsistency between the scope of D13D and D6A. D6A speaks of specific types of claims against an institution, but the jurisdictional bar of 1821D13D speaks about other sorts of claims.
Does it use anything that says other sorts of claims?
Well, it by its sure.
uses the word claims, right?
It says claims and actions, mm-hmm. and it defines what they are, and by their nature, by their definition,
D13D2 says claims, right?
Two says claims, one says claim or action.
Mm-hmm.
But look at two for a minute. It refers.
But that does not necessarily cause an inconsistency. It can be referencing back to the limited nature of claims that Judge Randolph have referred to from earlier in the same statutory scheme.
I don't believe that's correct, Your Honor. And the reason why
is. I understand why you don't believe that.
Well, could I explain why?
Okay.
It's because I think indeed. Sub 2, it refers to a claim that refers to an act or omission of the receiver. That would not give rise to a claim against the institution inherently. That's not possible. So if you're going to give effect to the language of D13D2, you can't limit its scope to claims against the institution.
Somehow or another, the claim that the bondholders have, it goes through the administrative process in D6. Will you tell me how then, and it's denied?
They can bring this case.
Where do they get the what provision gives a court jurisdiction to review that denial?
The inherent, anything that goes through and is denied in the claim process is then subject to court review.
Under D6, it's only claims against depository institutions. And under D13, it says, except as they're provided, no court shall have jurisdiction over any claim relating to. So where do we get jurisdiction?
I think, again, going back to auction, if you interpret D6 to include within it the claims that are barred under D13D, it would be that provision. You would be interpreting D6 to provide for judicial review of
claims. The language that says claims against depository institutions to mean claims against third parties?
Claims that are within the scope of D13D is how I would interpret that, Your Honor. And I think that's consistency, and it gives full effect to the statute and also the principle behind the statute. Because what you get are, as you've looked at all these other claims against the receiver itself, claims against and claims against third parties like Village of Oakwood. I'm not saying it's you have to rely upon it or are bound by it, but those type of claims where people try to circumvent the fact that they cannot sue the FDIC and
Village of Oakwood had an aiding and abetting claim in it.
It's true, and Your Honor, depending, Your Honor, it was an aiding and abetting claim, but it was a independent.
It was aiding and abetting the FDIC's act. Excuse me.
But again, Your Honor,
it's very different from this case.
No, I don't believe it's very different, Your Honor, than this case. And I think if you read the entirety of their complaint, what you will find, as Mr. Brooks referred to, is they allege that this was a fire sale price that was sold for its true value, but they allege in this complaint that the FDIC sold this bank for less than the bank was worth at the time it sold it. That's what they allege in this complaint. So whether you want to call it aiding and abetting, it's creative and pleading.
In response to Judge Randolph, when he asked you your question, you said they would just simply have to file this claim with the FDIC, have it denied, I assume because the FDIC would say they have no authority to do anything about it, then they could sue, right?
The FDIC could do things with this claim, but not grant relief against J.P. Morgan Chase.
So then it denies relief. They could sue then?
Yes, I believe they.
So you don't buy the FDIC's alternative argument?
No, I do, Your Honor. They could They can bring a claim, but the claim would be subject to dismissal at that point as one that they don't have the right to bring because, Your Honor, it is a claim that is a derivative claim. And they don't have standing to maintain a derivative claim. This claim is derivative. It's derivative under any state's law. Look at the unjust enrichment claim. It's not unjust enrichment based upon them. It's unjust enrichment that we got the value of the bank for less than we should have paid to the bank.
What state law do you think applies?
Your Honor, I believe that you're dealing with a federal association here. Which is governed by federal common law, which would look to applicable state law, which I think is going to look to the state law of Washington probably, because that's where the principal place of business of this institution is. So if that's the law you were going to look at, that's where you would go look, I believe.
Could you say again what it is the FDIC? You said the FDIC can't grant any relief on this claim because it's against a third party. Say again what it could do.
Well, the FDIC can look at this claim, right, which implicates its conduct, whether challenging.
Well, that's one way to read it. There's another way to read it, which is that it doesn't.
It relates to its conduct. I'm not saying it implicates it, it relates to.
Two different, very different issues. If you read the complaint as not implicating anything, any misconduct of the FDIC, just assume for a minute that that's the way I read it. What could the FDIC do in the claims process?
The FDIC could look through this claim and say, you know what, this is a legitimate claim. I'm going to deny the claim for relief. I'm going to issue a ruling here that suggests that this claim is not one you have, and I could go bring this claim. It wants to bring this claim. If it's a claim on behalf of the institution.
And suppose the FDIC looks at it and says this is a legitimate claim, but we don't have the resources to bring it, so Could the plaintiffs bring it then?
Well, the FDIC has $1.9 billion in resources sitting there to bring this claim.
They have to allocate resources.
They have to.
That's not much of an answer to my question.
Well, the answer to the question is no, Your Honor. They cannot bring it because they don't have standing to bring it, and they can't second-guess the judgment of the FDIC in bringing or not bringing claims on behalf of the failed institution. Mm-hmm. It is not their job as individual creditors to decide what claims owned by the failed institution should or should not be brought.
But what about their argument that these are, what about their argument that these are not derivative claims? They are, in fact, direct claims.
Those arguments are incorrect. As a matter of law, these are derivative.
As a matter of what law?
As a matter of any state law, under any state law that I'm familiar with,
these
are derivative
claims. Do we have that issue briefed here? How do we know that?
We do cite a number of cases in our brief.
Maybe we should remand this to the district court to answer that question.
I think you don't need to. I think you can decide it on jurisdictional grounds and don't need to address that issue.
But if we did address it, the L. Melvin and Myers case stands for the proposition it's a state law question.
Exactly.
It's not federal common law, and it's not incorporation of state law, as you put it, as a pure state law question.
Well, I think you're going to get to state law, and you're going to get to Washington law, as where this institution is, as to who controls the claims of this institution. I believe we cited a number of cases in our brief that address the fact that individual creditors don't have rights to bring claims for unjust enrichment, for claims that are common to the creditors and shareholders of the institution as a whole, as this claim is inherently. Putting aside the second issue about whether this is fairly traceable, which is another issue. Anyway, Your Honor, I see I've exceeded my brief time as well.
Unless my colleagues have further questions.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. And I will arbitrarily and capriciously award 3 minutes for rebuttal to the appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. We didn't see the FDIC, and we don't think the FDIC did anything wrong. The FDIC is not a necessary party here. Rule 19 was not even applied below. Rule 19, in fact, was turned on its head. Rule 19 says a party is only necessary and should be added when they won't deprive the court of subject matter jurisdiction. Here, the court below found that the FDIC was a necessary party in order to take away subject matter jurisdiction. The FDIC wasn't a necessary party here anyway. We don't need the FDIC as a party to prove the facts of this sale or what the sale amount is. That's all we have to prove, that there was a sale and what the facts of the sale were.
Derivable from your original complaint, or do we have to look to your proposed amendment in order to come to that conclusion?
Your Honor, I think that's true under either complaint. Let me address quickly the amendment issue. There was no explanation given for the dismissal with prejudice, which means the Rule 59 motion should have been granted. Once it was granted, the amendment should have been allowed under Rule 15. Judge Randolph, in terms of answering your question about the case, I've not looked at the case you specifically cited, but our argument is that the statute doesn't require exhaustion here. Our argument is that these claims are not the type that need to be exhausted. Auction Company found there are certain claims that don't need to go through the FIREA process. In Auction Company, the claim itself in that case, they said it was not subject to the FIREA exhaustion process. So we know there are claims out there that don't have to go through the FIREA exhaustion process. The question is this one of those kind of claims? And the answer is yes, because it's a third-party claim that says nothing about any FDIC wrongdoing.
Is Auction Company a holding or a dicta, or is it dicta?
Your Honor, we submit that I don't believe that it's dicta. I think that it was a clarification on rehearing where the court was trying to make clear what its precedent was going to be. And because of that, I submit that it's...
Was it necessary to the decision of that case?
It was necessary for them to find that the claims were not subject to the exhaustion process. So, yes, they held there are claims out there that are not subject to the FIREA exhaustion process. Once you cross that bridge, that there's some claims that are not subject to the FIREA exhaustion process, that means that if it's a claim against the FDIC corporate, the same should be the case for third-party claims. Your Honor, essentially what we have here is something akin to the FDIC being granted an absolution of sins like the Pope has, where by contract they can confer immunity. That is simply not something this court should allow. And I submit that these are third-party state court claims. FIREA, if applied as broadly as the appellees say, would deprive the state court of its jurisdiction over state claims, and it should not be interpreted in a way under for federalism reasons that deprives the state courts of its right to have such claims adjudicated.
And we're out of time again, unless my colleagues have further questions. Seeing none, thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.